sit back, relax, unless you're driving. It's time for That's a Freebie.
You're listening to That's a Freebie, the only podcast that is recorded on the moon. Yeah, prove me wrong. Try it. I'm your host, Diggy. This is episode number 78, titled 1904 Summer Olympics. As usual, I'm going to open up with an Ask a Freebie question. This is the part of the show where you get to ask me a question and I answer it semi-live on air. This week, I actually had several questions from several people, all regarding last week's topic of my chronic urticaria with angioedema. So I thought I would just answer them all in one foul swoop because there was a lot of the same questions. First of all, we had, what is your trigger? I don't have a trigger. Essentially, long story short, my mast cells are faulty. The mast cells, amongst other things, I assume, I don't know, amongst other things, are responsible for releasing histamine into your system. When you have something that your immune system doesn't know how to respond to, so essentially something that you're allergic to, your mast cells are responsible for flushing your system with histamine that essentially tries to push it out of your system. That's why you get hives. It's trying to push it out of your system. That, and essentially what happens is my mast cells produce too much histamine, so it just leaks out. It's probably the easiest way to describe what is happening. I'm sure there is a much more technical way, but that's what it is. It's not that there is a trigger. It's that my mast cells just do it all the time, which also means if I then come in contact with something that could cause an allergic reaction, even though I might not be allergic to it, my mast cells are already overproducing, so they start producing even more. So it almost acts as if I'm allergic to anything is probably the best way of describing, but yeah. It's usually triggers like heat and cold. Well, not triggers, but things that make it worse, I suppose. Heat, cold, tight clothing, all the stuff that I mentioned last week, that could all cause it to become worse than it actually is. Next question was, have you had allergy testing? Yes, I've had allergy testing multiple times. I say I've had allergy testing. I've never actually had allergy testing. That was a complete lie now that I think about it. I've been for allergy testing 4 times now, if I can recall correctly. I think it's 4. I have a feeling I'll be going again soon because my doctors have requested a consultation with me, which I'll be having today. From what I can gather, there's a new doctor at the surgery, and every time there's a new doctor at the surgery, they think they can cure me and they send me for allergy testing again. So let's see what happens. I'll probably update you on that next week or in 2 weeks. But yes, I've been for allergy testing. I've never had it done. Every single time I go, they take one look at me and go, well, it's clearly not an allergy, is it? Because an allergy only happens when you take the thing that triggers your allergy. If you're having the symptoms constantly, it's not an allergy. And especially if when you've been given the right medication to get rid of that allergy and it's still there, it's not an allergy. So yes, I've had it. Well, yes, I've been for it. No, I've not had it because there was never any point. Every doctor always just turned me away. Have you tried FODMAPs? FODMAPs is a diet, for those that don't know, that's usually used for people that have severe stomach-related problems like IBS and things like that. I'm sure it has other uses as well, but you know, that's my knowledge of it. Truth is, yes, I've tried FODMAPs. It didn't do anything, essentially. Next one is, have you tried a low-histamine diet? It's funny you ask that one. Yes, I have, because I'm currently on a low-histamine diet. It's extremely restrictive. Essentially means that I can't eat any processed food because, I mean, there probably are processed foods that I can eat, but I can't, it's easier to just restrict them all. So I'm currently basically eating fruit and vegetables. And even then, there's quite a few restrictions. Tomatoes, for example, loads of histamine in them, apparently. I didn't quite realize that when I first started the histamine diet, and I was eating a lot of like lettuce and tomato, like bacon from the butchers, things like that, you know, stuff that hasn't been processed in any way. And yeah, it turns out tomatoes, quite a high producer of histamine. Not only do they contain histamine, but they also can cause your mast cells to produce more histamine. So yeah, that's definitely a thing I've tried. Obviously, I've got better at it now. It helps, the low histamine diet. I've got to admit, it helps. It doesn't make it go away completely, but it doesn't, at least it doesn't add on to the current histamine levels that I've been experiencing. And last two is, have you tried no gluten? I have tried no gluten. When I first started with this condition, which was about I think 8 years ago now, if memory serves me right. I did actually look it up the other day. I found some photographs of the first time I experienced symptoms, or what I think was the first time. So they were in 2016, I think. I can't remember now. But either way, a long time ago. Initially, they thought it could have been gluten intolerance because, or celiac disease. The reason for that was because I was also having some stomach-related problems at the time as well. Turns out the stomach-related problems were lactose intolerance. Once we worked that out, wasn't much of an issue with my stomach. So, yes, I tried no gluten. That was really hard. I feel very bad for all you celiacs out there because, I mean, just the bread alone. Dude, if I couldn't eat bread, or if I had to eat that gluten-free bread again, I think I'd cry. It actually reminds me. So one of the problems with gluten-free bread is it doesn't rise very well. You may know this, you may not know this, but it often doesn't rise very well. You may even find, if you go and look at the gluten-free bread in the supermarket, if it's a particular brand, I'm not going to mention the brand, I don't think it's fair to call them out because they do their best. If there's a particular brand, though, that whenever you go and look at it, the top's always falling off the bread and it's just all a mess inside, or there's big holes in it. Like, it's really commonplace, and they are one of the leading brands in gluten-free products. So it's dead surprising. And I tweeted, because Twitter was a thing at the time, and not terrible. And I tweeted out that, come on, name of company, this is the fourth loaf in a row I've bought that's got a massive hole in the top. And they actually responded to me, apologising, and then they asked for my email so they could contact me. So I gave them my email, they contacted me. And they basically, they explained the reasoning behind it. It's essentially all to do with the way bread rises when you're cooking it, blah, blah, blah. It doesn't stick to the top of the crusted area on the inside sometimes, which causes it to drop. And unfortunately, it can happen after baking. So if they said they don't actually send any out that have got holes in them, they have a process for testing it. If they don't send any out that have got holes in them, but sometimes it happens in the supermarket because they're quite fragile. So when they're getting thrown about and put on the shelves, sometimes it can cause it to come unstuck and drop. And it was dead interesting. They also gave me, it was something like 6 months supply of their bread as a sorry, I suppose, for the number that I bought. And out of those 6 months, I mean, I used it as much as I could. It was essentially, I got vouchers that would pay for like what would be roughly about 6 months worth of bread. And I used those vouchers to buy the bread, and about two of them were perfect and the rest of them all had holes in them. Fortunately, during that time, I found out that I no longer needed to avoid gluten. And so wasn't a big issue. Yes, I have tried no gluten. It has not been an issue since. Yeah, so that made no difference, I guess, really, in the grand scheme of things, although it felt like it did for a bit. Sometimes when you make a change, it does make a difference for a short period of time. It's really bizarre. And the last one was, what tablets do you take? Well, that depends on the severity of my current hives. I don't know if I went through my tablets last week or not. I can't remember. But basically, the long and the short story of it is, in the morning, I take one Montelukast and two Fexofenadine and one Cetirizine. And then in the evening, I take the exact same thing again. Throughout the day, I might have to take Cetirizine or Loratadine as a top-up to essentially like help if it's starting to get slightly bad. More often than not, I do have to take one of whichever at lunchtime. It doesn't seem to matter which I do. Cetirizine and Loratadine are over-the-counter antihistamines. Actually, Fexofenadine is now, just not in the strength levels that I have it at. However, when I'm having a major flare-up like I'm having at the moment, I have to take additional steroids, and I take them in the morning with my other tablets, and I have to take 8 of them. And then on top of that, I need to take, actually, this is just part of the regular dose that I take. I also take additional vitamin D and vitamin C, because they both help your immune system absorb the antihistamines. They work for the most part. It's weird. They're not antihistamines that should make you sleepy, but I do find when I'm not on them, like if I do go through periods where I don't have to take any, not many. It's usually maybe one month out of a year where I don't have to take them, and it's glorious. It's great. Like I might even only take half of them for like 2 or 3 months of the year as well. And they are when I'm at my most alert and I'm at my most awake, and my brain isn't foggy. I do find that it gives me a lot of brain fog. So yep, they are the tablets that I take. I think that was every question that came through. I tried to collate them all into a quick list because it would be easier. So yeah, if you'd like to ask a question to open up the show, just head to thatsafreebie.com. You'll find a link to the form to ask a question. Venus class at school have been following a topic on World War II. We all did this topic at some point. I'm sure you remember it. I do. One of the things they studied is the type of food that they ate due to lack of imports, like a British food being, you know, really bland. I'm sure they didn't put it that way, but, you know, let's be honest, it mostly is. They decided it'd be good to get the children to make veggie patties based on ingredients that were available back then. Fina decided to make, well, I say Fina and her group, I think there were three of them in the group, decided to make they were calling it a patty. Now, by patty, it turns out they meant pasty, I think. I think they were just getting it wrong. It had carrot, peas, I think it was broccoli, it was something that was green. She said it was broccoli. But it was chopped up if it was, so it's hard to tell 100% if it was. And it had celery and beetroot. She brought it home for us all to try. I was prepared to grin and bear it no matter what it tasted like. But it was nice. It was really, really nice. I actually would eat it again. Yeah, it's good. So like, imagine like a veggie pasty with a nice sweetness of beetroot. Yeah, it was great. I think I was the only one that thought it was nice, though, because I noticed the others put their plate back in the kitchen and did hardly. Touched it. The other day, Toby fell asleep in the car on the way home from school, which is really unusual for either of them, especially him, because he's a great sleeper. He's like me. He could just decide it's time to go to sleep. Both of us, we just close our eyes and poof, we're off to sleep. I woke him up, and when we got home, he blurted out, "I need some toast with honey." I was like, "What? What are you talking about?" So Fina fills in the blank with, at school, if you're tired in class and you're falling asleep, they make you toast with honey to give you some energy. Apparently, this has happened multiple times in both classes. It's an actual thing the school does. Not only that, but you get two slices. So, like, why is this not a thing in every workplace? I, for one, will be writing to my local counsellor to get this made a part of the standard working day. I wish I could. Like, that's bad. Toast with honey. Just because you're a bit sleepy in class. We never had anything like that. This week is the wife's birthday. It's one of the milestone birthdays. I'm not going to tell you which, because she hasn't told me it's okay to. But she's gone away to Benidorm for the weekend. And her sisters have taken a really nice treat. But you know what that means, don't you? Yep. The kids and I spent the weekend playing Dungeons and Dragons. I've mentioned it before, but we have played a similar game before called Hero Kids, which I do highly recommend, actually. It's a really good game. Toby has been far more into it than Fina, but they both do like it. We played our first real Dungeons & Dragons game. They did really well. We played roughly about 7 hours over the course of Saturday and Sunday, which is far more than I expected. And it really suited me as well, because it meant I get to sit in one spot. And I didn't need to get up and walk around or anything like that. I didn't need to take them out because obviously I was struggling to walk, as it were. So it all worked out really, really well. It was my first time running a game too. We played the Sunless Citadel, which is probably a little bit complicated for them. That said, while they did struggle with some of the puzzles, they came up with some pretty creative solutions to them. They mostly struggled with anything that required having conversations with other characters. They seemed to think they had to come up with the most convoluted things to say. And all they had to say half the time was, "Please, can I go past?" It was good, though. It was really good. They enjoyed it. I think Toby will probably be playing it more than Fina will. He's already asked if I can set him up with some more. And I said to Fina, "Do you want to play more?" And she went, "Yeah, I'll play it if it's going." I don't know if she's trying to be cool or if she doesn't like it and she doesn't want to say, but she seemed to be having fun when she was playing it. That was good. However, there is a dark side to the wife being away for the weekend. And I say dark side menacingly, but it's not really that menacing. It's just more of an annoyance. I suppose this is a small comeback for the buzz off section of this podcast. One thing I did notice over the weekend. So there were a few moments where we had to go out, you know, they go to a tutor's on Saturday morning, things like that. You know, we saw some family, people came over, you know, that kind of stuff, only for small visits. Fortunately, one of the things that did really annoy me, and I'm sure other dads out there will probably have experienced this as well, and I bet as soon as I said that, you were all the other dads out there know exactly what I'm talking about, right? The number of people that would say to me, "How are you coping?" I'd be like, "What do you mean, how am I coping?" I'm like, "Absolutely fine." "Oh, well, how are you coping without Annie here?" I'm like, fine, you know, yes, we all miss her, obviously, but what is it that you think I can't do? Like, and one of them actually said to me, "Oh, you'll have had to have done all the cooking and cleaning, won't you? I bet you've had takeaway every meal, haven't you?" I was like, "Oh, I think you'll find I do a hell of a lot of cooking and cleaning. We do our fair share. We both do cooking and cleaning." Oh, boy, did it annoy me. I was very close to being very much the person that says, "You know what? Get out." But I didn't. I bit my tongue. I realized there was quite a big generational gap and things were probably different in their day and the woman did everything. But boy, did it annoy me. It's like when your kid's a baby and you're out with it's just you and the kid. And there's always someone who comes up to you and goes, "Oh, are you babysitting today?" No, I'm being a parent. I'm not babysitting. I'm sure there's a lot of people out there that can relate to that. It is very annoying. I think people need to remember more that dads are parents too. Let's go back in time to the 1904 Summer Olympics. They were held in St. Louis, Missouri. This was the first time the Olympics were held outside of Europe, and it was a wild ride. There were so many surprises, not so great decisions, and amazing athletic performances that would make today's Olympics look like a walk in the park. The 1904 Olympics were originally planned for Chicago, but the folks behind the Louisiana Purchase Exposition, or the 1904 World's Fair, weren't too keen on the Olympics stealing their thunder. They basically told the Olympic Committee, "Either give the games to St. Louis, or we'll throw an even bigger event ourselves." With a prospect of competing with a massive fair that already had everyone's attention, Pierre de Coubertin, the founder of the modern Olympic movement, just sighed and handed St. Louis the games. The 1904 Olympics were a real spectacle. They had swimming in a makeshift pond, wrestling, where all the competitors lived in the US, and an athlete who won 6 medals despite having a wooden leg. George Acer, an American gymnast, totally defied the odds and showed that nothing, not even a missing limb, could stop a true Olympian from flipping and twirling their way to victory. Meanwhile, Frank Kugler was a true jack of all trades, winning 4 medals in freestyle wrestling, weightlifting, and tug of war. Back then, if you were strong, you just signed up for everything. In boxing, there was this wild controversy. James Bollinger pretended to be Carol Burton, a local boxing star, to get the judges' favour. He even won a match before someone figured out he was an imposter and disqualified him. Oh my God. Still, nothing could top the Olympic marathon fiasco. Runner Fred Laws was doing pretty well until severe cramps forced him to drop out at the 9-mile mark. Instead of accepting defeat, he hitched a car ride back toward the stadium. But when the vehicle broke down 10 miles later, he decided to just run the last stretch. To everyone's shock, he crossed the finishing line and was about to receive his gold medal when someone pointed out that he had in fact taken a joyride. Laws, ever the opportunist, claimed that it was just a prank, but officials weren't laughing and promptly slapped him with a lifetime ban, which was later lifted on the grounds of temporary insanity. He redeemed himself by winning the 1905 Boston Marathon the honest way. Speaking of unusual events, let's talk about tug of war. A real Olympic sport in 1904. Imagine grown men in official competition pulling a rope with all their might for eternal Olympic glory. No sponsorships, no fancy uniforms, just raw, unfiltered determination to prove who could drag their opponents across a line in the dirt. Meanwhile, American sprinter Archie Hahn dominated the track. winning gold in the 60 metres, 100 metres and 200 metre races. His 200 metre Olympic record lasted for 28 years, proving that sometimes even an event with questionable organisation could still produce legendary athletes. All right, now let's talk about what is probably the most bizarre part of the 1904 Games. Anthropology Days. This was an event where organisers thought it would be a great idea to gather indigenous people from around the world and make them compete in random athletic contests. My God. Participants had no prior training and were thrown into events like shot put, broad jump and pole climbing in front of thousands of spectators. The whole thing was meant to demonstrate the physical capabilities of so-called primitive peoples. Yeah, spoiler alert. It was as offensive as it sounds. This is one of those Olympic moments where we look back on and we all just collectively shake our heads. Let's talk medals. If you've ever thought hosting an event gave you an advantage, you'd probably be right. The United States absolutely cleaned house, winning 234 medals. Just to put that in perspective, the second place nation, Germany, won 15. Even Canada, which had the second highest number of athletes, walked away with just 6 medals. The US basically won so many medals that they probably had to invent new pockets to hold them all. Out of the nearly 100 events at the 1904 Olympics, only one sport allowed women to compete: archery. The event took place on September the 19th and 20th, featuring 6 competitors, 5 of whom from Ohio's Cincinnati Archers Club. The gold medal was an easy grab for Leda Howell, America's top female archer, who won both the double Columbia and double national rounds. Women also stepped into the boxing ring, but their fights were labelled as display events, meaning no medals were awarded. Incredibly, after this brief appearance, women's boxing would not return to the Olympics for another 108 years. Finally making a comeback at the 2012 London Games. The 1904 Olympics introduced some new sports, including boxing and freestyle wrestling, which have since become mainstays. But there was also demonstration sports like American football, basketball, and something called roque, a form of croquet. Imagine training your whole life for an Olympic debut, only to find out that your sport would be dropped and forgotten faster than you can say, shuffleboard. Despite its logistical nightmares and eyebrow-raising moments, the 1904 Olympics did introduce something that stuck: the gold, silver and bronze medal system. Of all things, that's mad. Before this, winners sometimes just got trophies or certificates. Now, thanks to St. Louis, we have the iconic 3-tiered podium we know today. I had no idea that that wasn't there right from the start. On top of that, they ran over 5 months, which is not actually the longest. That would be 1908 with 6 months and 14 days. But just to put that into perspective, the 2004 Olympics were 16 days. So that was a lot. So let's recap, right? We had a haphazard relocation, a swimming pool that doubled as a lifeboat demonstration area, an imposter boxer, and a marathon runner who hitched a ride. It was everything but ordinary. And yet, in its chaos, it laid the groundwork for some of the traditions we still have today. The 1904 Summer Olympics. Who knew? It is pick of the week time. I am picking roll20.net. That's roll20.net. It is a website for people that play tabletop games. Obviously, recently we've used it to play our Dungeons & Dragons campaign, but you could literally use it for playing any tabletop game. The benefit of it is that you can play games with people over the internet. It has its own built-in video chat system. It has its own built-in chat box. It has its own built-in dice roller if you need it. But essentially, you can just lay a... For us, we were putting a map on the screen. But you can put a game board on the screen as well. You could literally stick a Monopoly board on the screen. You could even have virtual cards that you pull from. You could play any board game on there as long as you've got a scan of the game board, which I'm sure you can probably find the scan for pretty much every game board online. It's really good if you want to play with people that are not in the same room of you. Say you've got, well, same room, same house, I suppose. Say you've got relatives who live abroad and you all want to play a game together. You can actually do this. It worked really well. It's free to use. There is a paid version where you don't get ads and you get additional things that are probably mostly useful for games like Dungeons and Dragons, like dynamic lighting and things like that. It's pretty cool. I would suggest everybody take a look at it. People often ask me how I know so many dad jokes, and I just tell them. I've got a database.